Welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast, a weekly show featuring B2B sales leaders and executives. Hosted by five-time CRO John McMahon and Force Management co-founder John Kaplan, the show goes behind the scenes with the people who have been there, done that, and seen the results. If you enjoy our content, please subscribe, rate, and review the show to help us reach more people. Revenue Builders is brought to you by Force Management. We help companies improve sales performance, executing the growth strategy at the point of sale. Find us at forcemanagement.com. Enjoy today's episode.
Welcome to the Revenue Builders Podcast. I'm John McMahon, and I will be joined by my co-host, John Kaplan, who may be a little late since he's currently docking a boat, which is a puzzling problem and a confounding experience for the big man. Today, our special guest is Monica Stewart, who is a highly sought-after go-to-market consultant who helps steer businesses from stagnation to growth. Monica has over 15 years in the industry working with B2B software companies in the $2 million to $20 million revenue range. Her transformation approach is based on a sustainable, growth-focused mindset, making her an invaluable asset for the founder of the company that's seeking long-term success. She's worked with companies like LinkedIn, Trello, which was acquired by Atlassian, and Panjiva, which was acquired by S&P. Monica is also a seasoned speaker on sales and leadership. She's addressed national and international audiences on effective communication, enterprise sales strategy, and account growth. You can also find Monica on some podcasts like Sales Leadership and Surf and Sales, talking about sales, negotiation, leadership, change management, account-based sales, account growth, and discovery. So we're going to explore some of the common mistakes that B2B startups make when they're trying to grow their business. Welcome, Monica Stewart. So Monica, let's start by grounding the audience in exactly what you do for companies. So the way that I understand it, you consult with smaller startup B2B SaaS companies that are calling mainly on the enterprise. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So I work with SaaS startups that specifically are selling to large organizations. The companies that I work with are usually kind of in that range between 2 and 20 million ARR. So they've gotten over the first 1 to 2 million hump. They have some, you know, starting product market fit. They're not at like a Series C yet. And really kind of what sets them apart is all of the people that I work with are companies that have a really strong vision for where they want to go. And they have a timeline for doing that. And I think that kind of forces them to realize that there's usually kind of a gap between their strategy today and, you know, where they see themselves wanting to be in the next 3 to 5 years.
And then who do you mainly deal with at the company when you're consulting? Who calls you in?
It's always the CEO. Sometimes it will be, you know, like their co-founder. Sometimes it's a sales leader, but usually it's one of the founders who have been, you know, close enough to their sales and revenue org for long enough that they, you know, they kind of have a read for what's going on, but they feel like they need more information.
What do you think prompts a CEO to decide to consult with you? What do they see? Is it that breakdown between, like you explained, their vision and the timeline, or is it something, you know, more, you know, a lot more tangible than that?
You know, that's a really good question, John. It could really be, it's usually a combination of those things. I think about there was a founder that I talked to recently, and, you know, I'm kind of taking him through my discovery call and talking to him about what's going on in his business. And one of the questions that I always ask is, you know, why is this something that you want to commit your team's time and resources to now? And he was like, you know, Monica, he's like, here's the deal. Like, we've been doing this for 5 years. And this is not my first rodeo. Like, I've been an executive before. This isn't even my first company that I've founded. And we've been running at this really hard for 5 years, and it's been really fucking hard. Like, we've learned a lot. I'm really proud of where we've gotten to, but he's like, at this point, like, something's got to give. And so I think that that's really the main thing. It's they get to this point where they're like, I don't want to keep doing this like this for the next 3 years or 5 years or 10 years. Like, they know that they've gotten to a certain point that's pretty good, but they're working really hard. They're probably paying themselves less than they ever have in their entire career. They see that there are competitors in the market. They see that there are things that their team is doing well and that there are things that they still need to figure out. And they just kind of hit this wall where they're like, something's got to give. I need to try something different. I need help.
And then what have you found to be the typical, top problems that these companies might have in common? Is there 3 to 5 common areas that typically, once you go in, and is that breakdown between vision and their timeline, and they're getting frustrated? What are the maybe top 3 or 5 things that you find?
Mm-hmm. So I'll answer this question in a couple of different ways. Like, very tactically on the sales process side, usually you're looking at, they're not targeting their ICP specifically enough. So they'll have some really broad idea of the companies that they sell to. Like, we sell to HR teams at Fortune 500 companies. Like, okay, you and about 200 other people.
Yeah, that's pretty broad. Yeah.
It's pretty broad. Yeah.
So it doesn't talk about any use case or a specific persona in HR or maybe a more extensive understanding of the ICP, like you're explaining.
That's correct. Yeah. And, even if they have specific personas, for all of the people listening, if you're like, yeah, that's who we sell to, a better definition would be, we sell to VPs of employer brand and talent acquisition at Fortune 500 companies that are in hard to hire industries that, for whatever reason, because of, the industry being seen as outdated or recent bad press or something like that, are not able to attract hot talent in the age groups and with the skill sets that they want. Like, that's something that you can actually target against. So they usually don't have a super deep understanding of their ICP. So they'll know demographics and firmographics, but they don't really know the exographics or the psychological drivers. That would be one. I think a second one, process wise, is not having a really good understanding of their lead channels. So, especially if you're talking about companies that are under 5 million ARR, they're getting a combination of inbound events. They've probably got a couple of partners that they're working with. They're also getting personal introductions from the founding team, still, most likely. They're doing a little bit of outbound, and they're like, we'll just keep all these balls in the air because one of them is going to land, often enough that it's going to keep feeding our pipeline. And if you think about that strategy and then you scale it 20x, like, there's just no way, that a company can work like that. So that's the second one.
So then, and then on that one, Monica, so it sounds like what they're really not doing is prioritizing, okay, which 2 channels or 3 channels do we want to put most of our, arrows behind to basically, make our sales force most productive. If somebody wants to buy out of those other 3 channels,
mm-hmm. Sure,
we'll sell it to them, but we're not going to spend a lot of time on those channels because that's not a top priority for us. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. Yeah. I think it's sort of the same idea as, people don't want to give anything up by narrowing their ICP, and they don't want to give anything up by narrowing their lead channels, especially at those early stages. But what the smartest companies are doing is they're saying, 8 times out of 10, when I press this button, I get a good lead out of it. And so I'm just going to keep pressing that button. And then find another button, and then find another button, and then find another.
Otherwise, button. What you're describing is they're trying to be all things to all people, and you simply can't do that. You can't be good at all things, right? You have to figure out what you're really good at, where your leads really come from, where do I put my people to spend their most amount of time on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kills me to see, companies that have their revenue organization is less than 20 people, and they're trying to sell to 3 different market segments, to 5 different personas across 4 different channels. And it's like, guys, you're not Salesforce, huge, bigger companies can do that because they're building completely separate revenue organizations that are all under the same umbrella of the company. And the product team can support that, and the marketing team can support that. But, you really don't want to do that, pre-series C at least. And then another really big one that I see is they are really excited about their they're really excited about their ARR and their new business, and they just don't pay any attention to their NRR metrics until it's almost too late.
So what do they do? Essentially just sell and walk away? They don't really have like a strong CS organization, or they don't compensate their salespeople to making sure that they get the renewal and they get an upsell and cross sell?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. So they're under hiring, and they're hiring far more junior on the CS side than they are on the sales side. They are not putting like appropriate processes and controls in place post sale to kind of complete the second part of the sale. So especially, right, like when you're a startup selling to enterprise companies, one of the things that people really underestimate is the change management component of what needs to happen with your customers in order for them to really be able to get the value that they were hoping to get from you. And every once in a while, you'll get a customer that really knows how to do this, and they're used to working with startups, and they're used to bringing on new products. They just have a great internal process, and they kind of do it for you. And those will end up being like your early like, wow, case studies. And really what it is like they figured out how to get value from you, like in spite of you in a lot of cases.
Yes.
Right. And then the team is like, oh my gosh, like we crushed it. And it's like, well, actually they crushed it, you know, and we gave them something really good to work with. And they were a good customer for us. So yeah, they'll just kind of bumble through that part. And, you know, candidly, a lot of the time, the prices that those companies are charging for those earlier contracts are not that high, right? Like they're not doing like $500,000 contracts, $3 million contracts.
Right. They might doing $30,000 deals
with
Morgan Stanley. So they got a tiger by the tail, and maybe for the size of their organization, like you said, 20 people in sales and no one in CS. The last type of companies that you want to get is these massive Fortune 500 companies that can, you know, you got a tiger by the tail and they can drag you around any way they want. Mm-hmm. And all you got out of it was 20 grand. I mean, it's just not working.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so then you end up with, you know, you get Morgan Stanley in at 20K or 60K, and then they come to the kickoff call with like this whole list of requirements and this whole like rollout, and they want you to do 30 global trainings in person. And you're like, whoa, what? And you go to the salesperson, like, why didn't you tell me about this? And they're like, well, it's Morgan Stanley. What are we not going to do it? So that's like scenario number one. Scenario number two, which I think is equally as bad, is like, you know, so you close Morgan Stanley for 30K, and then a kickoff call happens. It's like three junior people. Only one of them has seen your product before. That SVP or C-level person that was involved in the sales process, never to be seen again. No one really knows why you're there, or what they're supposed to be doing with you. And you can maybe even renew that account a couple of times. But, you know, later on when you want to raise money, or maybe you're starting to look at selling and you're going back through your book and you're like, you know, investors are like, Morgan Stanley's paying you $30,000. Right. You know, do you think you can get more out of that? And then you go and you try, and they're like, we actually forgot that you were even like, that we were even using you guys, because you just got like kicked down to some tiny, tiny, tiny little part of their organization. And then you realize too late that like you don't really have Morgan Stanley as a customer. You have like two people at Morgan Stanley. Yeah.
And the other thing right there is that's when those companies churn. Those pros, because what happens is when the CFO and other people are looking to cut budgets, they go to each individual and they say, hey, this thing you bought for 20 grand, tell me the value you're getting out of it. Why do you have to have it? And they don't have an answer. So they go, great, let's cut it. So those things get cut. And that's to your point where they're not paying attention to their like net dollar retention rates.
Yeah.
And their churn goes up also.
Or you get oversold because one of your larger competitors introduces a good enough product and nobody even knows that they already have you. So they get the other one and then you get pushed out that way.
Yes.
So let me just, this has been awesome dialogue. I just want to recap what we're talking about here. And Monica, you've done a great job. Johnny asked you, like, what are three of the top problems that you see? I just want to highlight these, and I want to go a little bit deeper on a couple of them for takeaways for people that are listening right now. The first one, you said sales process not targeting their ICP specifically enough. And I really, really liked what you said there. The next one you said was not having a good understanding of their lead channels, which these are really, really powerful. And then really, you know, focus on ARR versus NRR metrics and, you know, not really having a good connection to the back end of the sale. And then we just kind of followed up with that with like, not all revenue is good revenue.
Yeah.
So, and then tiger by the tail. I love that. I want to go back to the ICP one. So let's say I am a founder, an investor, a CRO candidate for a company. And like, what are some of the top things I should be able to answer about my ICP? Like, what would you expect me to be able to say about my ICP for you to be able to say, you know what, they got it going on? Like, if I came to you and said, Monica, I'm looking at this company and, you know, they said this about the ICP. Tell me what a good answer is and what a bad answer is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So a bad answer would be, you know, we sell to basically the companies that everybody wants to sell to, right? We sell to McDonald's, Bank of America.
Brand names.
Brand names, exactly.
Yeah.
I think a good answer would be like, and this is really where I try to get my clients to, this is our ICP. Within that ICP, here's what our tier one, tier two, tier three looks like. Here's our non-ICP. Here's who we don't sell to and why. Good. And across each of those categories, what I'm looking for is like your standard firmographics, like, you know, revenue, number of employees.
Yeah, when you said firmographics, you said firmographics and what other graphics you said?
Demographics.
Okay, good. Yeah. Can you just explain? I think I understand what that means, but what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the firmographics are the characteristics of the company, like what you're going to filter for in your lead platform or whatever. And then the demographics are for your buyers. And so for that, we're not just looking for the title. We're looking for like, how old are they? Where do they live? What's their life like? How do they think? What else are they interested in?
What do you say to people, Monica, if I don't have that? So I'm a founder and I'm like, red flag, I don't have this data. What do you say and how do you help them?
Well, I mean, if you're at kind of the stage of your company where you and I are probably talking, you do have that data. You haven't taken the time to really look at it yet, right?
Right.
Like you've got customers, you've got 50, 60, 100 customers. And you've got 1 to 3 people, probably you should have more, but you probably know 1 to 3 people at each of those accounts. And so what we need to do is we just need to kind of go through that data. And some of this you can pull from your CRM right away. For the people listening to this and you're like, man, I'd like to have that. You can do this right now. Go to your CRM, pull a list of all of your current customers, and then just start to populate in all of that data. And so it's like, you know, like I said, typical things like that help you to understand what the company looks like. And then what you want to do is you want to think about what are the couple of exographics or X factors that are specifically important to me because of the way that I help people. So that might be number of employees in a certain role that might, or do they have that role at all? That might be growth in a certain part of their business over a certain amount of time. It might be something about how many countries they operate in or how many transactions they do or certain type of technology they use, like whatever it is that makes you, when you get on a discovery call with a prospect, that makes you light up. And you know, that thing that you write down and you circle it and you're like, ah, they just switched to HubSpot, you know, whatever it is for you. Those are the things that you're not going to be able to target companies based on that in a lot of cases. I mean, effectively, with a lot of the tools that we have available now, you kind of can, but they're going to be things that, like, after you have that first call, that's what's going to help you to understand how good of a deal is this going to be for you and for them.
Yeah. One of the things that I found in the ICP is, and this is from real life experience, maybe John, I won't name the company, but maybe Johnny remembers. I went into a company first day. We started talking about the ICP. It had everybody in the room, you know, CEO, CMO, VP of development, everybody, product management. tell me the use. I went down to the use cases. So they had the firmographics, right? But let's go through the use cases.
Mm-hmm.
On the whiteboard, they list 13 use cases. And I said, this doesn't work for me. And they said, why not? And I said, well, I can't build a sales force that can be world-class in 13 different use cases.
That's
I looked
right.
at the CMO and I said, and you can't message world-class to 13 use cases. I looked at the development person and said, you can't build a product to be world-class in 13 different use cases. So we're going to have to narrow this down to 3 or 4 use cases, or this is probably not the right place for me.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, that's another way where you got to narrow the focus of the ICP way beyond, to your point, firmographics and demographics.
Yep.
And so I remember.
How did that go?
It went great. The company wound up, you know, sales started going 100% a year and we went public and then we got.
Oh, you're gonna say that without saying you hired me?
We didn't.
Dog.
I said you remembered it. You can always.
I do remember it. I remember the phone call.
Like I was there.
Yeah, I was there. Hey, Monica and Johnny, I really want to hit home on this because we've talked a lot about ICP. You guys are doing such a good job of really going deeper and talking about the importance of narrowing it. I just want to help the audience think about this. Like if you get this wrong and you look at like the fundamental building blocks of sales effectiveness, like Monica and Johnny just talked about messaging and not being able to, how do you create messaging when you don't have, you know, the right ICP? Move down a level, you know, move down another level and talk about sales process. Who's doing what, when, and where in the sales process amongst a non-defined ICP and a non-defined sales process you're going to have? Let's talk about creating a plan to make the plan. When I look in, I say, what's your plan to make the plan? The first thing I do is I look at all these companies that they say they're going to get the, you know, to make their plan. And it's no distinguishable ICP to me. And I know they're not going to make their number. And then the last thing is, walk me through the not in play A players that you want to hire. Mm-hmm. And how are you going to qualify that they are going to and verify that they are going to not only thrive, but dominate in an environment like this because they have experience with this ICP. So what we're really talking about here is if you don't get this right, you're done. You'll never make it. And there's a whole graveyard full of startups that fail right here. Monica, comment.
Yeah, 100%. You know, you're totally right. And I think if you're coming from the perspective of, you know, the two of you have so much experience in this area, or somebody like me, it's so simple, right? Like we come into these conference rooms and we talk to these companies and we're like, what do you mean? Like, that's how you're doing things. There's no way this isn't going to work. We got to change everything. And something that that I've really learned in doing this work is, so why are they like this? Why do companies do this? Because at the end of the day, like these founders aren't stupid and the people that they hired aren't stupid either. They might not have done this one thing before that we are all very specifically skilled at, but they're super bright, super capable people. And so why do they operate this way? And that was kind of one of the things that I focused on for many years, trying to figure out how to help companies. And what I realized is that all of this that we see is exactly why they are where they are. Like that's how they got the success that had that puts them in a position to even be able to work with somebody like us. And so, you know, rightly so, when we come in and we're like, oh my God, what are you doing? You got to change everything. You guys don't know how to run a sales organization. There's a part of them that's like, yeah, they're right. They're right. I mean, that's why they're here. But then there's another part of them that are like, what do you know? You know, like I've been here since the beginning. I've been here hustling for all of these customers that we got, and our CTO closed a deal, and this random guy that we hired from a big company that's kind of helping us close a deal. And like, you know, everybody has contributed something, and, you know, we look at it and we're like, that whole process was a mess. We can't believe that you guys were able to get these customers. But they have been doing something that's working. And, you know, candidly, like if you've only got, I talk to companies like this all the time that want to do this. And I tell them, no, if you have 5 customers, it is not the time for you to do a full ICP exercise and create your hiring plan. And
great point.
right? Because like, it's going to be wrong. And so you have, they actually have to go through this stage where they kind of are like muddling through and they're doing it wrong. And, you know, it's probably better for them to like, my friend Rob Snyder runs a great program called PMF Camp, where I send all companies that are not ready to scale like this. And as you guys know, 70% of startups fail because of premature scaling. And so I do have a like a deep respect and empathy and acknowledgement of why they ended up in this like strange, chaotic sort of revenue strategy soup.
It's kind of like Monica, it's kind of like it's their best thinking that got them there. It's not bad thinking. It's their best thinking that got them there, right?
Right. That's right. And I think this is one of the things that's just so hard about really making it as a startup. Then your thinking has to change. And then your thinking has to change again at 10 million. And then it has to change again at 30 million. And then it has to change again. And you know, at a certain point along that journey, you might be like, my thinking in this company has gone as far as it's going to go. I think maybe somebody else should, you know, should be the CEO. But that's, I think, the thing that I've seen that really separates the people that are able to go far versus the people that have a good idea is that willingness at certain stages to completely rethink everything that has gotten them to where they are.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just to your point, it's not just the ICP that has to change every year. I mean, as your product develops and your competition develops and the customer gets smarter, you have to constantly update your ICP and even your sales process and a whole bunch of other processes that you do inside your company. But one of the things I want to go back to, Monica, is what I've seen in a lot of startups is the tech founders built the product, and they believe that everyone's going to buy their baby.
Yeah, so good.
But when they first sell to Morgan Stanley and then some car company and then some airplane company and some other company, they think, well, this is the way it happens. You know, every vertical, every company in the world is just going to buy my product. And then they start, to your point, they start prematurely scaling. Let's put some people in verticals. Let's put people in major accounts. Let's go after these territories. And they're really not ready because they don't understand the ICP. They don't understand the three whys of why people buy, why your product's differentiated, and why they have to buy now. They don't understand any of this stuff. They burn a whole bunch of money. They miss the numbers a couple quarters in a row. And then all of a sudden they realize, hey, you know, we need somebody like Monica to come in here and help us. Monica comes in and helps us. They have to redo everything. And then they're almost lucky if they survive and can get another round of the funding. But it was all self-inflicted.
It is. Yeah, it was all self-inflicted. And I think one of the things also that they don't really, understanding the three whys is important. And then understanding like, you have to really, really, really ask people why they want to go with you. And, you know, what I see all the time with companies is they're, you know, they're talking to Morgan Stanley and Morgan Stanley's like, yeah, this looks great. This is, we love this. This is exactly what we're looking for. And then the salesperson writes down goals, wants to be able to save time with manual processes or whatever they think it is that their product does. And they don't really qualify like, explain to me, like, in your words, what problem do you think this solves for you? And then what does that mean in the world of what you guys are doing outside of the conversation that you and I are having right now about our product? And they don't, like, they don't nail the problem priority match. And so if you don't have an understanding of like what the metrics are that you are tying to that already existed for your customer before they even ever heard of you, then you're not really going to be able to get far in those organizations. And so I feel like we could spend like a whole episode just talking about like,
no, just on that.
We can.
You have to understand the before metrics and the after metrics. Otherwise, to the earlier point, when you only got $20,000 or $30,000 from a Morgan Stanley and the CFO is looking to cut, and they come to you and say, what value are you getting out of this software from XYZ Corporation? And they shrug their shoulders and they can't quantify the value. It gets cut.
Let's talk about why this happens. You guys are bringing up such a great point. We're kind of talking about these technical founders, really, really smart people, really understand, you know, how to build products. And so I want to just empathize for a second. Mm-hmm. Most of the people that we talk to, Monica, I'm sure the same for you, the answers are in the room. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is if they just allow themselves to think outside in versus inside out, mm-hmm. if they just put the customer on the board for a second, all mm-hmm. these smart people in the room, CMO, CFO, CTOs, whatever, and I don't care if it's just two people in the beginning of a company, you look up at that and you say, everything we do is about that, if we have the ICP, is about that buyer. Okay, so the first thing is they got to go outside in versus inside out. And they typically don't do that. Technical founders are very inside out. They're like, this is the technology. And guess what? They have to be. Because if you don't have product market fit, we got Bubkiss. We got nothing to talk about. Okay, so that's number one. Johnny, you always talk about don't confuse activity with success. And a lot of times what we do, the reason why this is allowed to happen is because people get happy ears and happy eyes on activity and not specific activity. And then the last thing is that I just want to comment on here is, Monica, you talked about this. This is a hard one because these same things we're talking about change at stages. And teams can change, Monica. Even technical founders can change. We see a lot of technical founders in the beginning at different stages, and then the stage comes and they're no longer the CEO. Now they're on the board That's not necessarily a bad thing. Can you talk to us a little bit, Monica, about some of your thinking as it relates to people? Nick Saban, former coach of Alabama, used to say, you got to play where your feet are. And what that meant was, you can't think about the last play. You can't think about the future play. You got to think about right now where we are. And sometimes leadership teams, they don't play where their feet are. How do you help people say, okay, you're in this stage. This is the expectation. When you move to these stages, you might expect certain changes. Could you help us with that?
Yeah, that's such a good analogy. I'm not a sports person at all, but this one kind of lands. I would say that if you don't have an intentional process for having these conversations in your company, I can almost guarantee you that the members of your leadership team are actually standing in different places. Some of them are standing in the past. Some of them are standing in a future. Some of them are standing in a different present state than you are. And so one of the things that I do with my clients, first thing that we do when we start working together is we go through a self-assessment process where they just benchmark themselves across five different pillars based on the stage that they're at, right? So like, okay, if you're, you know, like 0 to 1 million, 1 to 3, 3 to 5, et cetera, this is broad strokes, like what these parts of your organization should look like. This is like ideal state. And then where would you kind of target yourself? Is that exactly where you are? Are you like halfway there? Does that look nothing like where you are? And it's not, you know, it's not super in depth. It's not like a 30-step questionnaire, but it does give us all a single place to look together and start to have an objective conversation about kind of how they're tracking against the five key parts of their organization that they need to move forward in the revenue org in order to get to the next stage. So that's kind of like the first thing that we do. And then you would think that from there, all we have to do is like, okay, here's what you guys should focus on. Here's your roadmap. Let's go. But what I've realized after doing this for many years is there's a whole change management process that needs to happen with that team in order for these things to really take hold. So once they do that, then we have to have like a real conversation about what the things are that they need to fix and why they need to fix them. So, you know,
and Monica, do you have the right people in place to fix them at this stage? Could you talk about that? Because people lose their mind when they're thinking, well, wait a second, the CRO that I hired is not the right person for at this stage. And the expectations, very rarely, Johnny, right? Very rarely do we see somebody, you know, like a Chris Degnan or what have you, start off as a sales rep, go to a CRO and then keep going. You know, the guy at Snowflake does an outstanding job. That's rare. Very rarely does somebody continue on that process.
Yeah, 100%. You know, my mom has this saying, right plant, right place. And yeah. That's kind of how you have to think about teams. Like most of the people that are in your organization, every once in a while you get someone, you know, who's toxic, negative, bad influence. There's no place for somebody like that on your team. But in most cases, it might be that, well, first of all, you have to look at the roles that you have, and then you have to look at the people that you have in those roles. And a lot of times there are roles that are missing that, you know, you can kind of move people around into. I always say, like, you hired the people that you hired for a reason. And if you really just take a step back and you ask yourself, are they a net positive to the organization? If the answer is yes, then most times you can find a place for that person, because, you know, most startups under 20 million have not overhired, at least not the ones that I work with. They're not in like hyperscale mode.
That's right.
But after that, the second kind of pass that you have to go through is coachability. And that's really what it comes down to. Like, you know, I'm a huge fan of Marshall Goldsmith, "What got you here won't get you there." And it's like, it's a very simple framework. It's like his philosophy, for those people that haven't read the book, is that once you reach a certain level of competency in whatever your profession is, then after that, all of your growth and also all of your problems are personal. And, you know, I work with sales teams. And so if you look at sales teams, like, sorry guys, but sales
is easy. Like, we're going to resemble some of these remarks, Johnny. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's not rocket science here. I mean, it's my profession too. It's not easy, but it's simple. Let's put it that way. And so, you know, all of your growth after a certain stage with your team is like, how willing are they to look at like their own limiting beliefs, their own hangups, their own insecurities, and kind of grow in that way. But if, you know, if you've got a team that is coachable and bought in, there's probably some shifting that you can do to make it work. But, you know, I think that for founders, you have to really be attached to the mission and not attached to how you're going to get there.
Okay. So let's go back on
very loyal to their teams. And like, the thing is like those team members might leave you too, you know, like you have to be true to like the destiny of your company, not the destiny of any individual team member.
Right. Okay. So here, awesome. I want to go back on this. So first of all, they have to be receptive to what Monica says. And I want you to tell typically me how receptive typically that they are.
Now you're talking about like the CEO, right?
Yeah. Or any changes that Monica is going to recommend, you know, how receptive are they to these recommendations?
Johnny, hit on the coachability piece here, because that's where you're going. Like, how do you know somebody's coachable?
Hold on a second. So first of all, how receptive are they to the recommendations which you make, which means that there's going to be process changes, people changes, a number of those things. And then if they are receptive, or to John's point, coachable, now how committed are they in following through on those recommendations, which in most cases typically involves more than a process? It's going to mean I'm going to have to switch around some people. And I'm starting to feel, based upon what you said, that that's where a lot of these organizations stop. They say, oh, I'm really receptive to what she said. That makes sense. It's logical. It's reasonable. We're not doing those things. I could do those things. Then all of a sudden they got to change processes. Not a problem. Change people. Ooh, boy, I don't know if I could do that. Then the whole thing grinds to a halt. Am I sensing that right?
Yeah. You know, there's a third part of it too, which is that you're 100% right on with the commitment part. And, you know, if your question is how committed do they have to be to making these changes, the answer to that question is 110% committed.
Right.
I would say that it even goes beyond the people, and it goes to, okay, so if your company is less than 100 people, the psychology and the personality of that organization as the founder, it's you. it is you projected onto this group of people. And so if you look at your team, I'm going to get a little bit deep here. You know, if you look at your team of 50 and you're like, they are distracted, they are in the weeds, they are, you know, they're not using their resources effectively, we don't have leverage. Those are all of the things that you need to work on as a leader, because everybody else is just kind of following your lead. And actually where I usually find the most resistance is getting the founder to change their own priorities and change things that they're doing. I find it's really easy for people to say like, yes, this is what we're doing. We're committing to this plan. Everyone listen up, sales team, listen up, CS team, listen up, product team, do what they say, da, 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 da. But in the back of their mind, they're like, but she doesn't mean me. And I absolutely do mean them. Because you know what's going to happen, you know, 3-4 months after we have that meeting and we have this big rollout, is like they're going to get some idea and they've got like a partner that they're talking to on the side, or they have like some big speculative deal that they're working on, you know, the CEO of Morgan Stanley with, or whatever it is. And they're like, yeah, I'm just going to like, you know, just do this on over here.
Were just kidding.
Yeah. And I'm like, I wasn't joking. Like, I mean, you too. So people,
it wasn't a question.
It wasn't a question. Like I was looking right at you, man. People need to understand that, like, they're like, yeah, we want to do these things. They need to also be able to say like, what am I willing to say no to in order to really make this work? Because you can't keep doing all the things that you were doing before and do something else and think that it's really going to have a massive impact.
Yeah. The last thing I want to talk about on the subject, I want to just put a bow on this on coachability. And I'm just going to tell you the truth on me. You know, I've noticed that when I struggle with coachability, it's really related to a couple of things. Like, and you can do a self-assessment right now. If you're listening to this, you got to do this self-assessment. Because when somebody's giving you feedback, if you're trying to figure out how to change their mind on the feedback, you're probably coming at it from the wrong place. Meaning, I was just working with the board, Johnny and Monica, over the weekend. I was just working with the board on something that's pretty important to me. And I was talking to one of the board members, and one of the board members, every suggestion that I made, they kept telling me how they'd done that before.
Oh, no.
And after about the fifth time, I wanted to say, hey, sounds like your best thinking is what got you on the phone with me today. Like, you know, why do you need me? So I didn't do that. I almost lost my mind. And the reason why I didn't lose my mind is because I could empathize. It's right. Like when you know you're coachable, there's always something to be learned. And if you are comfortable in your own skin, then don't think about trying to prove somebody wrong. Let them speak. Let them give you the feedback and then decide what you want to take from that. And you don't even have to respond to it. Like if you think that they're out of context, they don't have the right information or what have you, you don't, it's not about making a response to somebody unless somebody's telling you, hey, respond to me on this. Mm-hmm. But what I find is that people are too often living in the excuse department. They're like, oh, I know why that happened because this person didn't do that and that person didn't do that. And I told them to do this and they didn't do that. And then the last thing I wanted to say, just to give people some spirit around this, is when you find that this direction is lacking, Johnny, you and I talk about this all the time, it's always related to the why. The why is missing. And sometimes technical founders struggle with the why, because the why is actually success in the future. And it's not really playing where your feet are today. It's playing where your feet are going to be, because that's what gets people to sign up and motivate them. And I find that people just don't do a good job of beginning with the why. So I want to just put a bow on this one. If you know what I'm saying, if you're not coachable, or somebody tells you you're coachable or not coachable, probably revolves around the things we just said. And then also, if you're having trouble getting people to sign up, you probably haven't hit the why. Comments?
Yeah. Yeah, I would. I think that both of those are super, super, super accurate points. I think that orienting, like consistently orienting your team around the vision, is one of the most important things that you can do to inspire coachability. Like the most successful founders that I've worked with, they are so committed to where they're going, and they're willing to, you know, temporarily become almost anybody in order to get there. And okay, those are the founders that you see that are like, okay, I'm an AE now. Okay, cool. I'm going to be a great AE. Yeah. Okay, now I'm an HR person. Okay, great. I'm going to like hire all these people and coach them. Like they can shapeshift because they're not,
or they think they can shapeshift.
They think they can, they're doing it right. Like they're willing to go on that path. They take feedback really well because they're more attached to the end of the story than what their role is in that story. Like they don't need to be the hero. They don't need to be the white knight. They don't need to be the wizard. Yeah. They don't need to be the guy that has all the answers. They just want to be the guy that ends up with the prize at the end. And if you can get everyone on your team to think like that, I think that's really powerful.
Now, Monica, when I first would go out and advise companies or consult with them, I remember grabbing the handle of the door when I was walking in and thinking, I don't know anything about this company. I wonder how they help them. But after like an hour or two in there, I would walk out and think, this company's a mess. Like there's 100 things they need to do right. But then I would sit back and say, okay, there's 100 things that they need to do. But if I'm going to have impact with this company, I have to prioritize the 1, 2, or 3 things that they can do like now that's going to show impact so that they'll start to continue to buy into what I'm telling them. So have you found that that's an issue? Because if you just say change ICP, okay, change ICP, but it's going to be a while before we actually go and sell deals underneath that ICP. So how have you been able to navigate that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, usually when I kind of go through that assessment benchmarking exercise with companies, and they're coming with their own ideas too of what they need to change, right? They're like, the product team doesn't listen to us and our CS team doesn't know what they're doing. And they have their own ideas of what.
But it's always pointing the finger somewhere else. It's never pointing the finger at themselves, right?
That's right. Yeah. And so then we do that together and then we kind of point the finger back at them. And then we end up with this list of like 10 things. And so what I'm always looking for, also because I'm impatient and I want to see them win too. Like I have a client right now that is going to, their goal for this quarter is like 4x what they closed in Q4, and like, they're going to hit it. And I'm so freaking excited for them. Like, this is fun for me too. It's selfish. It's not just for them. It's also for me. And so what I'm always looking for is like, what are the things that are going to give you the most leverage?
Right.
So that we can kind of then work down the list and there's less pressure as we keep going. So, you know, a really easy kind of rubric for this that anybody listening can apply to their own list of things that they have in their company is, if you're looking for the areas of that are going to give you the most leverage, usually what you want to do is you want to work from the bottom of your funnel up. Most people tend to work from, they're like, they work from the top of the funnel down. They're like, oh, we need more leads. And then they're like, oh, okay, well, we need to close the leads better. We need to have better conversion rates. And then like, maybe we need more people to handle all the leads or generate more leads or whatever it is. And then they worry about the rest later, like we talked about earlier. And usually what's going to give you the most leverage right away is working from the bottom of your funnel up. So like, let's go to the biggest customers that you have right now, make sure that we're doing a really great job with them. Now let's go make sure that every new customer that your team is signing, because you've got a bunch of stuff in the pipeline that's about to close, is being handled in a way that's going to set you up for the best conversations with them, most expansion with them, highest LTV with them later on. Great. Now that's all done. Now everyone that we put through that part of your process is like, good. Like, we don't have to worry about that. Then let's look at all these deals that you've got in your CRM, prioritize them. Let's take the top priority ones, close those, make sure we have a good process for doing that. Okay, cool. Now you just close some big deals, cleared a bunch of shit out of your pipeline that was never going to close. Now let's figure out like where that next batch of people is going to come from. So that's an oversimplified version, but I would say, you know, if you look at where the biggest piles of money are concentrated in your business and optimize that part of the process first, and then work your way through the rest.
Yeah. But that also requires that they are actually very good at qualifying deals that are in the bottom of the funnel.
Yes.
Uh-oh. Don't get him started.
I mean, then, but like, do you want to have that conversation now or do you want to keep delaying it? I would rather.
No, you're right. You need to have it now because that means if they're not qualifying deals really well in the bottom of the funnel, then ones that are coming in the top are probably not also very not qualified. The other
qualified
thing,
qualified sales on, leader, Johnny, the qualified sales leader authored by John McMahon. Go pick it up.
So, Monica, one other thing I want to touch on was earlier you said, you know, they're doing a pretty good job of acquiring customers, but their net dollar retention rates are really bad. Churn's really high. Do they ever look at the cost of customer acquisition, or is that too early in most of those companies?
I think that for most companies, they are, it depends on the stage of company that you're talking about. I would say that like, once you get around, you know, 10 million and then you're going to 15 and 20, this is a good time to start looking at your customer acquisition costs, because before that, you're not probably making really significant investments in marketing or really significant investments in your team. You've got like a CRM, you've got Apollo, you've got SalesNav, like you're not buying a bunch of tools yet, right? But when you start looking at kind of growing that team past the $10 million, $20 million mark, that's when things can start to bloat. So, you know, I would say that it's a good thing to have like a rough eye on. Obviously, you don't want to do anything ridiculous. Like you're not flying three members of your team across the country for the day to take someone to lunch to close an 80K deal. You probably should not be doing that. If anyone's doing that, DM me, we'll talk. But like in general, I think don't try to over-engineer it at the beginning. But then once you start kind of cracking like the 10 million line, it's a good time to kind of start to go back. And when you're, now that you're doing your budgeting and you're forecasting for like the next 5 to 10 million in ARR, start to layer that in so that you can make sure that you're not getting ahead of your skis.
So do you think, let's go back to the beginning. Do you think it is the CEO that has an awakening, or do you think it's somebody on the board that's telling the CEO to have an awakening? Is maybe their burn rate's too high to the number, you know, maybe that to the net, you know, new dollar ACV and, you know, somebody on the board saying, hey, you're going to have to get this right, or you're just never going to get another round of funding, you know, Where does the prompt really come from? I can't, because it's hard to believe that all of a sudden a CEO wakes up one day and just says, even though they've been doing it 5 years, just says, you know, it's time for a change. Does somebody else prompt them for that? Or do they just get fed up? What really happens?
I've seen it. I've actually seen it happen both ways. I would say that 80% of the time, it really is the founder. In their kind of forward thinking and their self-awareness, you know, kind of like thinking honestly through like, all right, if we keep going on this trajectory, what is that probably going to look like given everything that I know from my experience? And then how does that match up to where I want us to be? And then they're kind of coming to this on their own. I also work with a lot of VC firms, and I've found that they will make a gentle suggestion and maybe like introduce one of their founders. Maybe you should talk to Monica. Like she's got some pretty good ideas, but it's very rare that they'll really come down and mandate, hey, you guys need to do something. PE firms are different. I have seen a couple of times that I'll talk to someone and, you know, they're very confident in their strategy. And then they go and they have a board meeting and they get their ass kicked, and then they come back and they're like, maybe we should talk about the strategy a little bit. I don't know. Just want to hear what you have to say. So every once in a while that happens, but I'd say 80-85% of the time it's really the founder, and it has to be, because at the end of the day, there's a tremendous amount of commitment and buy-in that's going to be needed from them, in order to do this work.
Yeah. Because it's tough, right? What you're really describing are CEOs and companies that have a really difficult time self-diagnosing what their issues are.
That's right.
Then they realize through probing from someone else or on their own, like things just aren't going the way they should go. So they bring Monica in. Monica comes in. She recommends changes. which is really hard for them to probably swallow because they can't self-diagnose their own problems. So if I can't self-diagnose what's going on with myself, now I'm going to rely on Monica. She tells me this, these things. I'm going to have to take a huge leap of faith. And I think that's also the reason I asked the earlier question as to, you know, how do you get prioritize it to, you know, give the greatest impact on what you recommend first? Otherwise, you're going to lose them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, it's also like we co-create these priorities together. I mean, there's no way that I can come in on my own and tell somebody this is what you have to do, and then they're just going to say yes. So it's always like kind of a push-pull process. And, you know, it's funny, usually what happens, so we kind of do this, they do a self-assessment, we talk about it, we come up with a plan. And then once we decide to work together, I go in and I really get under the hood and do like a real deep dive, like get into all of their systems, et cetera, et cetera. And then I give them like a much more detailed, you know, this meeting takes a couple of hours. And at that point, usually it's really funny, but usually they're like, we thought you were going to be much harder on us. Like, that's it. Are you sure there's not like, are you sure it's not worse? Like, cause we also had all these other things that we were worried about. And that's when I know that I'm like, okay, cool. This kind of like, this is going to go well. Like, because now I can tell that they're also thinking about it really critically. Mm-hmm. Like while I'm doing my work, they're starting to do their own revisions and think and be like, well, how would I look at this differently if I was looking at this from, you know, a perspective of, you know, somebody like Monica that does this for a living. And so we're kind of going on that journey together. And I think that's kind of how it has to be. I would say,
what you're saying, you know, is it doesn't mean that they don't have those 100 other problems. It says Monica's given us the top 5 or 10 things we need to change to have the most impact, right?
That's right. Yeah. It's sort of like once you see it, you can't unsee it. And it changes the way that you look at your organization forever. I would say that, you know, for any founders listening to this that are like waiting on their VCs to tell them what they should do, I just want people to remember that VC firms don't give companies money because they think that company is going to succeed or even because they necessarily need it to succeed. They give companies money because they want to spread their risk out amongst a broad portfolio. And they know that a good percentage of the companies that they invest in are going to fail. And if you happen to be one of them, their life doesn't really change that much, but yours does.
Truth.
So at the end of the day, like you really need to be accountable for your own story.
It's so powerful because the VCs can make 20 investments. So you get one. You get one.
Yes.
You have to make it work.
Yeah, that's right.
And if they make 2 grand slam home runs, they look like a hero, even though the other 18 went out of business. Mm-hmm. But you get one.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny, as usual, we got about we get past like the first 3 questions in this this plan guide.
Awesome.
What a great conversation, Monica.
He was like, I don't know if it's going to be that many questions, but we'll figure it out. Yeah, this was
great. Great job. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Monica. Monica, is there anything you think that we didn't talk about that you really want to emphasize?
No, I think we covered so much, and it felt like it flowed in a pretty like organic way, which I think is good. Like, I don't want to come on here and be like, here's my talking points. Make sure that I get to all of them.
No,
this is more valuable for people. So this was really great. And let me know when it comes out. I'll promote it on my page and everything. And, you know, if your audience likes it, I'd be happy to come on again sometime.
Okay. You killed it. We'd love to have you again.
Awesome.
Thank you, Monica Stewart. Thank you, John Kaplan. Thanks, everyone, for listening to another episode of the Revenue Builders Podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Be sure to check us out at forcemanagement.com.